Hachette Audio presents The Secrets of My Life, written by Caitlin Jenner with Buzz Bissinger, read by Aaron Bennett, with a special introduction by Caitlin Jenner.
Hi, everybody. I'm Caitlin Jenner, and I wrote the book Secrets of My Life. Now, why did I write the book? I had a story to tell that has been inside me all of my life. I never thought I would have the opportunity to tell my entire story. But at the age of 65, raised all my children, all doing extraordinarily well, there I was back out in Malibu, all by myself, thinking to myself, is this where I'm going to spend the rest of my life? And never have the opportunity to tell my story. And I decided, after long conversations with my children, with my family, and of course with God and my pastor, I decided to live my life authentically and see if I can make a difference in the world. I really hope that you like this story, because it took my entire life to finally share it with you. And the reason I wrote it is because, you know what? This is not a self-help book in the sense I've done that in the past. This is my story, my very personal story. And in telling that story, I overcame what I call my stuff. Everybody has their own stuff. Everybody has things deep down inside them that they're hiding. They're not being honest with themselves. And in reading my story, I hope that it is an inspiration for other people to live their life authentically, because there's nothing better than living your life with no secrets. Now, the hardest part about writing the book and telling my story was I am very blessed to have a very large family. And when you go 65 years, that family becomes quite large. And anytime you go through a transition or go through what I've gone through, it affects a lot of people. And my mission was, how can I do this and not hurt the ones that I love? Because they are by far the most important. It's not the public. It's not the media. It's none of that. It's about the people who love you and who are going to share this experience with you. I never, ever wanted to hurt anybody. And that was by far the toughest part of it. How do I do this book and tell my story honestly and not have a negative impact on the ones that I love? I really feel like in the book we accomplished that. It wasn't easy. We had 8,000 pages of memoirs over a 2-year span. There was an enormous amount of material that had to be organized, put together into the book form. And in doing that, I had to be honest, but then I also had to make sure that I was telling my story. And in doing that, I just didn't want to hurt anybody. Sometimes being honest with yourself can be very difficult. Now, they asked why I'm not narrating the entire audiobook. Okay, I have to be honest. My entire life dyslexic. I'm not a good, fluid reader. I thought it would have taken an enormous amount of time to get through the book. I just thought it was easier if we had a really good narrator to be able to put the book in proper perspective without editing all the time to make sure that I get it done. So that was really the reason. Because when I was growing up, I had two things that really affected me. One was being dyslexic. I was always in the slower classes. I was always a poor reader. I always thought everybody else was smarter than me. Everybody else was a better student than me. Everybody was a better reader than I was. That, along with identity issues. And the identity side of it, in the 50s and 60s, you just had to depress it. You just could not talk about it. There wasn't even a word being trans, none of that stuff. Those were difficult times for me. So I really thought it would be a better read on the audio side of it if we had a professional do it. So that's the reason I didn't go through the entire book. Now, one of the best parts of doing this book was I had the opportunity to work with a Pulitzer Prize-winning writing journalist and author, Buzz Bissinger. We got along so well. Now, if you know anything about Buzz, he's a little bit crazy, And I love that about him. I knew that he would have, he's got issues of his own, and he would be able to put his touch on the writing. He did such a good job, and I'm just so proud of him. We have become good friends. We were together to do this book about 2 years in the process. Many, many, many hours of talking, of sitting down. And it was the best collaboration I've ever had of anything I've ever done. I'm really honored to have him work with me on this book. Now, the book really came out great. Now, I keep telling Buzz, you know, the reason it came out so good is because it's about the content. And he keeps trying to tell me that, no, it's all about the writing, you know, and we go back and forth. I said, but Buzz, you had wonderful content to work with. Of course, anybody could write it like that, but we've joked around and we did a lot of laughing, a lot of crying, and a lot of soul searching on this journey. And it was quite an experience to go through. And I am so excited for you to have the opportunity to read it. You can look into your own soul and overcome the obstacles. Well, what's next for Caitlin? I have a lot of things going on. Who knows which ones are going to work out and which one aren't. But for right now, I really want to concentrate on this book. I think it's a really important story to tell about living your life authentically. The trans issues does not have borders. It's about humanity. And this is an important story that I think needs to be told all around the world. So, for at least the next few months, and for as long as this book's out, I'm going to work on getting into as many hands as I possibly can, because I think it's an important book. And certainly for me, it's an extremely important book. So making sure that I do the publicity, the work that it takes to get it out really on a worldwide basis. So for right now, I'm working on book sales.
Dedication to the memory of my father, Bill, and my brother, Bert. Author's note. This is a book primarily of recollections. I believe them to be true, and I have cross-checked them with members of my family and friends and what has been written in the past. But they are based to a large degree on my memory, and memory, as we all know, is selective. There is absolutely no attempt to color what I see as the truth for my own purposes. There is much I regret because of my own actions, just as there is much I celebrate. All I can do is write about them with sincerity and candor. Transgender guidelines suggest that I no longer be referred to as Bruce in any circumstance. Here are my guidelines. I will refer to the name Bruce when I think it appropriate, and the name Caitlin when I think it appropriate. Bruce existed for 65 years, and Caitlin is just going on her second birthday. That's the reality. Biology loves variation. Biology loves differences. Society hates it. Milton Diamond. Prologue. I am at the Marriott Hotel in Orlando giving the speech to the sales force at Merck. Six in a row, one after the other, the same words and the same message and the same title and the same feigned enthusiasm, just like the hundreds of other times I have given it forward and backward across the country. It is the 1990s, but it could be the 1980s or the early 2000s. They have all merged together. I know why people are here in the audience. They are coming to listen to the Bruce Jenner who won the decathlon at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal and became dubbed, as is the tradition, the world's greatest athlete. They are coming to listen to the Bruce Jenner who saved the United States Olympic team from terrible disappointment at the hands of the Soviet Union and East Germany during our nation's bicentennial year. The Bruce Jenner who literally overnight became an American hero. The Bruce Jenner who is the essence of virility and is the ultimate conquistador of women. The Bruce Jenner who gets anything he wants. The Bruce Jenner who looks at himself in the mirror and sees a stud among studs. They don't know that when I look into the mirror, I see something entirely different. A body that I fundamentally loathe. A beard that is always noticeable no matter how close the shave. A penis that is useless except for pissing in the woods. A chest that should have breasts. A face with a jawline too sharp and a forehead too high. They don't know that contrary to what they imagine, I have slept with roughly 5 women in my life, and I was married to 3 of them. They only know what they see, which is the image I have carefully cultivated over those decades, which in turn is the image the media has bought into because it's the irresistible story they want to tell. The Olympian who rose out of nowhere and was the son of a tree surgeon and went to a tiny college in the middle of nowhere and married his college sweetheart and spent almost half his life to win the gold medal. In doing so, I have also come to represent, perhaps more than any other athlete of modern times, the America of hard work and realizing your dreams in which we all believe. The America I believe in, no matter how unbelievable I have become to myself. They know what they want to hear, a life defined by those 2 days at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, July 29 and 30, 1976, when I broke the world record and ran around the oval of the track afterward, waving a small American flag handed to me by an adoring fan. I was happy then, incredibly happy. Proud of my country and myself. And it took less than 24 hours for me to realize that the greatest diversion in my life, the grand diversion, the day-in and day-out training of the previous 12 years, was finished. Which raised the terrifying question any day and every day, what the hell am I going to do? What the hell am I going to do with my life? How much longer can I keep this up? How much longer can I hide and lie to those who still admire me and those I love? I go to bed with frustration and shame. I wake up with frustration and shame. They don't know that underneath the dark blue business suit, I am wearing panties and a bra and pantyhose. They don't know that I am not Bruce Jenner, but a woman I will come to call Caitlin, who still has to be Bruce except for stolen moments here and there. 20 minutes or an hour, or maybe 2, where I can feel what it is like to be my authentic self. Imagine denying your core and soul. Then add to it the almost impossible expectations that people have for you because you are the personification of the American male athlete. You can't imagine it. I am glad you can't, because it is unimaginable. Except to me, because I am living it, or trying to live it. Because you don't really live. You just try to get by. Pray that the conflict inside will, well, not go away completely, because you tried that already and it won't. But maybe take a breather. Move to the background of your mind instead of the foreground. Those in the audience don't know that despite my outgoing nature and a natural gift for small talk, because I do like people, I am always uncomfortable. All they know is what they want to know, and all I know is to tell them what they want to know. The speech I give to the Merck sales force is called Finding the Champion Within. I have no need for notes. I know it by heart. I can recover from failure and go on with life, and life will be good. We have to take fear and control it. You know when you're going down that road in life, and that road comes to a fork, and you gotta go one way or another. For some reason, I always kept taking the right direction to go. There was a time I believed those words, particularly in the aftermath of the Olympics, when I was preoccupied with the bounty of success. But now a certain word comes to mind. Bullshit. All bullshit. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Bruce Jenner. I am acting here because that's how it has been almost my entire life. I am playing Bruce because that's what the people listening to me want. That's what society wants. I get paid a lot of money for it, so I keep my mouth shut about who I am. I finish up the speech. I do the usual meet and greet afterward.
I fake my way through by talking sports with the guys and making small talk with the women because I cannot relate what is in my heart. All I really want to do is get out of there and go up to my hotel room. The truth is, I no longer give a rat's ass about the speech. I do it so I can make a living, but I really do it so I can get out on the road. Because it is only on the road that I can feel any self-fulfillment. My wife, Chris, will not permit any of this behavior at home, just like my two wives, Christy and Linda, before her. She doesn't want to see it or deal with it, so we never talk about it. Why would she? She fell for Bruce Jenner, not some porcelain doll knockoff. They all did. I wasn't totally honest with any of them. I was too ashamed, too scared. But it was more than just that. Just like my ex-wives, I couldn't conceive of it either. Bruce Jenner? Be serious. Of all the people in the world, could anyone be more unlikely? Bruce Jenner? I locked the door to my suite at the Marriott and put out the Do Not Disturb sign. I order room service, a tuna sandwich and a Diet Coke, and tell the waiter to just leave the tray outside the door. I turn on the television to sports that interest me, car racing and golf. There are several mirrors in the suite, which I like. The bathroom also has a makeup mirror, which I also like. I'm in business. The ritual actually begins before I even get to the Marriott. It starts at Los Angeles International Airport, where I have taken every possible precaution I can think of to get through security without incident. Nobody enjoys packing, but try packing for a man and a woman. I have a female friend who buys clothing for me since I am too scared to do it myself. I tell her what I need and she looks for it. But given that I am 6'2" tall and can't try anything on in person, it's hit or oftentimes miss. Shoes are particularly tricky because of my big feet. Good for the events in the decathlon, but not so good when you are trying to dress up without detection. The selection is further limited because I am assiduously avoiding heels that are too high. The last thing I need is to be taller. So it actually makes packing easier since I don't have many options, either for this trip or the dozens of trips I have already taken. I layer the outfits I'm going to wear at the bottom. Then I stuff a wig inside the sleeve of one of the garments and fold it over as extra precaution. I put my dark blue business suit on top, along with assorted socks and shirts and underwear. This is before 9/11, so security isn't nearly as stringent as it is today. If I am stopped and my luggage is searched for some reason, I can always say that I packed for both wife and husband. I have an excuse ready for any situation. Always think on your feet. Deny, deny, deny. But I still want to avoid questions, and a woman's wig on the top layer is far more likely to cause snickers and speculation that Bruce Jenner is, at a minimum, an Olympian-sized kinkster. I always bring a box of clear plastic wrap, which in my own homegrown method of feminization, I cinch tightly around my waist to heighten my hips and buttocks. And let's not forget the little tube of crazy glue I use to do a makeshift facelift. After extensive trial and error and many different types of adhesives, I have learned that it adheres remarkably well, but it's a bitch to get off if you use too much, removing a tiny patch of skin and leaving a visible red blotch. Fortunately, I have gone to the bathroom before security to remove the breast prosthesis I am wearing. I actually forgot once, and the alarm went off as I went through the metal detector. As the officer positioned his wand on my upper chest, I was convinced the detector had picked up something on the bra. I braced myself for being marched to a private room to remove my shirt, and I am pretty sure saying the prosthesis was for my wife would not have worked. The fear was palpable, until it turned out that the wand had picked up a zipper on the rain jacket I was wearing. I was a lot more careful after that. In this particular line of work, it is always better safe than sorry. I unpack and lay the clothing I will wear on the bed. Because I'm not one to experiment in a situation such as this, two items are almost always the same. One is a black dress with spaghetti straps at a length just above the knee, because if I know anything about myself, it's that the legs work. They have always been thin, much to the amazement of many, given my athletic success. I told them then that my legs are made to go, not show. Now it's the opposite when I get the chance. My legs are there to show, not go. I can't say the same thing about my arms. Definite no show. So the other item is a black jacket to hide them. I stole the clothing from Chris's closet because it is quite sizable, and I do not think she will notice them missing. By the time she discovered I had been borrowing them for several years, they had been stretched to all hell, and she did not want them back anyway. It is my go-to outfit, cute but not too formal, complemented with black shoes, because as we all know, black makes you thinner. I have stolen makeup over the years, not only from Chris, but the rest of the K-troop, Courtney and Kim and Chloe, and eventually Kendall and Kylie, because, trust me on this, there is more makeup per household user in our home than any in history. If you have watched Keeping Up with the Kardashians on the E! Network, you probably know this. Applying makeup is always the most intense, and I sometimes think I work harder on that than I did to win the decathlon. Although I have gotten better, it is still not a given as to how exactly I will look. In the past, I secretly bought how-to books since there was no one to help me. I keep the books, along with my meager collection of clothing, in a small closet with a lock and key in back of my own closet. Chris and I have negotiated this, since she is terrified, as I am, of the kids finding something. It almost happened once with Kendall and Kylie. One suspected the other of stealing clothing. I don't remember who was the detective and who was the alleged perpetrator. I do remember that one of them secretly activated the security camera on their computer. With everyone out of the house, I dressed up. I went into Kylie's room to check myself out because it had a full-length mirror. I thought nothing of it until later that night when I heard them running to their mother yelling, "Oh my God, what's on the computer screen?" They were mercifully too young to understand. It sounds funny now. It is funny. But not then. The embarrassment I felt was profound. I didn't want any of the kids to know. I didn't want to confuse them or scar them or hurt them. How could they possibly come to grips with this when not even I could? The episode was symptomatic of the tissue of lies I had built, never at peace with myself, total confusion. Fortunately, the episode was forgotten, but I learned a valuable lesson. Whenever the woman inside you wants to check herself out in the mirror in your kid's bedroom, make sure the computer is turned off. The eyes are the most important, because eyes, of course, are a window into the soul. You get the eyes right, and everything else follows. They come out fine. I'm definitely improving. But sometimes I get overconfident, and here I am, the world's greatest athlete, sitting there with my hands shaking, trying to put false eyelashes on, which only results in black glue all over my eyelids. I look at myself in the full-length mirror of the hotel room. I walk back and forth several times to make sure I am passable enough as a woman. I carry a purse, Chris's, of course, which is a little bit harder to borrow since she started keeping better track. I leave the room. I usually take the stairs to the lobby to avoid getting stuck on the elevator with other guests, but I am on a high floor and don't want to exit looking a mess, so I use the elevator. I don't say a word because my voice, sing-song and a little bit high-pitched, a combination of Midwest solid and Massachusetts twang, will give me away instantly after so many years in the public spotlight. I turn my back as if I am a disinterested, stuck-up broad, and I bend my knees a little bit to not look so tall. I leave the elevator and walk around the lobby for 20 minutes. Not a very good return on investment, since it took at least an hour to get dressed. It's exciting to me, and I sometimes wonder if that is the driving force, finding excitement in a life that no longer has any excitement, unless you call playing golf by yourself exciting, and believe me, it's not. Living with the Kardashian women and Kendall and Kylie is incredibly rewarding, don't get me wrong. They are dazzling, and in several years' time, keeping up with the Kardashians will draw millions of viewers worldwide. I come across in the reality show as a well-meaning but slightly doddering patriarch who has no life of his own and is subsumed by the women who surround him and only does what his wife tells him. In other words, a totally true depiction. I walk to the end of the Marriott lobby and then turn around and go back up to the hotel room. I never linger. I never stop. I never go to the restaurant. I look for remote crevices and corners. I try to avoid eye contact as much as possible, although I am acutely aware that I am being checked out. As Bruce Jenner, I have already been checked out thousands of times. The reason for the looks is different now. I'm not too worried about being recognized, because even if someone thinks they see Bruce Jenner in a dress, which they did, nobody is still going to believe they just saw Bruce Jenner in a dress, because Bruce Jenner is the last person you would ever expect to be wearing a dress if you have the slightest memory of the Olympics. The reaction that concerns me is whether or not I am presentable. The length of the glance is the key determinant. A quick one means, no big deal, it's just another woman. A longer one worries me, the implication being, what the hell is that? Sometimes I think I look pretty darn good. Other times I feel like a thinner version of Big Bird, standing out for the world to see and snicker at after I pass. There are very few good things about getting old, except that you shrink. So if I live to be 100, I will be 5'10" and maybe not feel so self-conscious. I think about these things. I remember once in another hotel how a man came up to me in the lobby. I was convinced this was it. Busted. Instead, he smiled and handed me a rose. I returned the smile and got away from him as quickly as I could. The last thing I wanted was a conversation. In the dozens of outings I have made to hotel lobbies over the years, I have never had a conversation with anyone. But I was flattered. I leave the Marriott and get into my rental car and drive around for an hour or so. This is something I also would do, depending on mood and how much time I have. I see a strip mall and park the car on the outskirts of the lot, as far away as possible from any security lights. I walk around for a little bit, holding the car keys in my hand in case of an unexpected encounter that requires a quick dash back to the car. Thank God I am in sensible shoes. I do not stay out very long, but even the freedom of walking around in the farthest corner of a mall parking lot is still momentarily liberating. It is incredibly exciting. The pulse quickens, the heart rate rises, a combination of giddiness and confidence and daring the world, and happiness, sublime happiness. Going back so many years to the age of 10, I am still trying to figure out why. Am I truly gender dysphoric, clinically defined by the American Psychiatric Association as a marked incongruence between one's experienced, expressed gender and assigned gender? Am I maybe just a cross-dresser deriving some sexual high? Sometimes I wonder if dressing up like this is the equivalent of having sex with myself, male and female, at the same time. I have no concrete answers. Occasionally, I venture out even beyond the parking lot, like the time I was staying at the Opryland Hotel in Nashville. The Opry Mills Mall is across the street. There was a multiplex cinema, and I thought, what the hell? Why not go to the movies by yourself? I went over earlier in the day and had Bruce buy the ticket. That afternoon, I gave the Finding the Champion Within speech. I went back to the hotel room and got fully dressed as the woman inside me. Then I walked to the multiplex and went right inside the darkened theater since I already had my ticket. I wanted popcorn. You have to eat popcorn when you are watching a movie, otherwise there is little point. But I was too scared to go to the concession stand. Fortunately, the movie was good and I got into it. And for 2 hours, everything else stopped. I left the theater afterward and had to go to the bathroom. I doubt that for anyone else there it was a complex decision. You have to go, so you go. For me, it was, oh my God, now what am I going to do? I had actually used the women's room before during previous outings. Like everything else, I had a particular routine. I would wait outside to make sure no one else was entering. That way I could go in by myself and use the stall farthest away from the door. If somebody came in, I would wait until she left. Then I would get the hell out of there. The line for the women's room was lengthy that day. There was no way I was going to wait. So I scuttled back to the hotel as quickly as I could and made it up to my room. I am still feeling good about myself when I get back. Nobody suspected anything. But I have an early flight tomorrow, which means Bruce will be back, rise and shine. Everything has to come off, unless I have a late departure. Then I sleep with the makeup on all night and it smears all over the pillow. Sorry, housekeeping. Outwardly, my life is good. Terrific children, a strong marriage, at least before Keeping Up with the Kardashians takes off. Steady work, a public that likes me. I continue to have a positive image. It is not enough. It will never be enough. At this point in my life in the 1990s, in my 40s, I honestly don't think I will ever get that peace in my soul. Concerns over family and the strictures of society are just too great. I seriously think about putting a stipulation into my will that I be buried as was always my gender. Maybe that's the best and only answer to be the woman I always was, wearing what I always wanted for more than 20 minutes in a hotel lobby, or going to a movie in the dark, or driving around aimlessly. That's the way I want to go to heaven. That's the way I want God to see me so I can finally ask him, did I blow it? Was there more I should have done? I yearn for the answer here on earth. But until I find it, I do what I do best. I play Bruce. Chapter 1. A Stupid Boy. I have been divorced 3 times. I have given away enough furniture to outfit IKEA. I have lost too many homes to count. I have few pictures of my family growing up. When I separated from Chris in 2013 and moved into a rented house in Malibu, the entire home was furnished in a day with items from Restoration Hardware chosen by her and a crew of roughly 50 she assembled. I didn't even bother to take with me the gold medal I had won in the Olympics. Chris kept it in the vault for safekeeping. I kept the accordion. I wonder why it is the only possession of mine that has lasted through those 3 divorces and 10 children and stepchildren. Why I have lugged it around for close to 60 years since I last played it when I was 8 or 9. Why it is on an upper shelf in the garage of the home I now live in, still in its original cumbersome case, collecting dust. It was only just recently I realized it was there when I cleaned out the garage. I think about many facets of my life, unequal parts wondrous and improbably absurdist. I worry about my relationship with my children and stepchildren, which I thought would make us closer now that I am Caitlin, but am so afraid has not. I think about whether to have the final surgery. I think about all the issues facing the transgender community and what I can do to help, because that has become a sacred commitment in my life. I still fear loneliness, just as I also know I am happier and more fulfilled than I ever have been. The accordion is just an instrument taking up space, a relic of the long ago past. But I believe that everything happens for a reason, so there must be a reason it is still with me. Sometimes I think if I can solve the riddle of its continued existence, I can solve the riddle of my life. World record-setting Olympic gold medalist with no interest in ever truly competing in anything else ever again after I won. A fraud when it came to being my authentic self. Public figure and private shadow. Good father to my stepchildren, but at one point abandoning my own children from my first 2 marriages. Assertive, yet deathly afraid of confrontation. A lover of people, yet lonely. Open, yet absent of empathy. Outwardly comfortable in my own skin, yet inwardly, desperately uncomfortable in it. Wanting to be liked, yet never quite sure I was liked, because there were so many moments when I did not like myself. I have felt different intensities of these feelings at different times. Some days were better than others. There were some days, even some blessedly long stretches, where I didn't examine my soul at all, or at least thought it was a phase that would pass, or that maybe it could be cured. 2 aspirin and a glass of water and a clove of garlic around the neck and a rabbit's foot under the pillow. For a long time, I did not understand what was happening. There was no context or point of reference. The term gender dysphoria, increasingly and mercifully a growing part of the vernacular today, had as much application in the world in which I grew up as Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Its first usage was not until 1974. America in 1949. It was 4 years after the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and Harry Truman was still president. The Volkswagen Beetle was introduced to America. Los Angeles recorded its largest snowfall ever. Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific opened on Broadway with Mary Martin, and Howard Unruh became the country's first single-episode mass murderer when he gunned down 13 neighbors in Camden, New Jersey, with a souvenir Luger. Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel were born that year. So were Meryl Streep and Sissy Spacek. Then there was me, on October 28, 1949, the same day an Air France jet crashed into the Azores and killed all on board, but also the 63rd birthday of the Statue of Liberty, typical of the conflict of my life. My coming of age was the 1950s, the American age of the automobile and the creation of the interstate system under Eisenhower, and McCarthyism and paranoia over communism, the age of Gunsmoke and Perry Mason and Bonanza and Leave It to Beaver and other shows in which virtually every major actor was a white male. In politics, there were no African Americans in the U.S. Senate and only one woman, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, who had been elected. I didn't know a single gay person growing up, or perhaps more accurately, I did not know a single person who would openly identify as gay because of the atmosphere that existed then. It is better today, but that same atmosphere still exists in too many places when it comes to being different from the status quo, which for me represents nothing except the arbitrary judgment of ignorant and hateful others. Roughly a year after I was born, the U.S. Senate Investigations Subcommittee of the Committee on Expenditures was directed to make an investigation into the employment by the government of what was termed as homosexuals and other sex perverts. Among their conclusions and findings, which still bear repeating, was the authorities agree that most sex deviates respond to psychiatric treatment and can be cured if they have a genuine desire to be cured. However, many overt homosexuals have no real desire to abandon their way of life, and in such cases, cures are difficult, if not impossible. These perverts will frequently attempt to entice normal individuals to engage in perverted practices. The lack of emotional stability which is found in most sex perverts and the weakness of their moral fiber makes them susceptible to the blandishments of the foreign espionage agent. It is the experience of intelligence experts that perverts are vulnerable to interrogation by a skilled questioner, and they seldom refuse to talk about themselves. To put it too mildly, it was hardly an age of enlightenment in the America in which I grew up. I wonder to what degree this environment influenced my conservatism, because I am sure it did. But it was also an age of increased bounty and consumerism, if you were white. Suburbs were rising, tens of thousands of affordable homes were being built, a middle class was burgeoning and booming. America was a safe and good place, if you were white, and I felt safe in that womb with my parents and my siblings as I grew up in Westchester County in New York and Eastern Connecticut. My father, William Bill Jenner, with a sense of humor as subtle and sly as his Boston accent was not, was emblematic of the greatest generation. He met my mother, Esther, at a roller skating rink in White Plains, New York, in the spring of 1942 after she had moved east from the Midwest. He was an excellent skater and was naturally skilled in many athletic activities. He had the ability to instantly master whatever he tried, a trait I was lucky enough to inherit. My mom was a wobbler on skates and slightly nervous as a result. She remembers it with her typical razor-edge bluntness. Could I have this next skate? Well, it's your funeral. Esther was from Ohio and had spent a good portion of her youth on a 73-acre farm at the top of a sloping hill near Shadyside, overlooking the Ohio River. Her father, a portrait photographer by trade, was a man of remarkable determination and focus in areas that intrigued him, essential qualities I inherited that served me in training for the decathlon. He built the house they lived in, sturdy and modest. In his spare time, he was an amateur geologist, astronomer, and maker of telescopes. He loved to tinker and mechanically experiment, just like me. Bill had been born in the city of St. John's in Newfoundland and Labrador, Canada, moved with his family to Somerville, Massachusetts, and then Westboro. When he was young, a terrible hurricane swept New England, downing thousands of trees. The logs were stored in lakes, and Bill's father ran a portable lumber mill, moving from lake to lake. Bill worked there for a year after high school, and then moved to Tarrytown in Westchester County, New York, in the late 1930s. Esther found Bill maddeningly handsome, and it sounds as if Bill did too. Clearly, vanity runs in the family. He was working for his brother's tree service and had a happy-go-lucky personality that Esther found infectious. They quickly fell in love, as many couples did back then, perhaps because they knew time was running out. They got married in September 1942, when Esther was 16. America had declared war on both Germany and Japan, and Bill, like millions of young men his age, was desperate to fight. Because he was still a Canadian citizen, laws prevented him from enlisting in the U.S. Armed Services. He could make himself eligible for the draft, but the minimum age then was 20, and Bill was 19. On what seemed like a daily basis, he went to his local army recruiter in New York to sign up for the draft. The recruiter finally could not take it anymore. "Have you got your birth certificate?" Bill produced his birth certificate. "Let me see it." "Yes, sir." The recruiter changed the date of his birth in pencil to make him 20 years old. "You'll hear in a couple of weeks. Now don't bother me anymore." 3 months into the marriage, Bill went off to the army, and Esther did not see him for 3 years. She wrote to him every day, even though she quickly ran out of interesting things to say. She worried about my dad, and there was ample cause for worry. He did not just want to be a member of the army. He signed up to be an army ranger, one of those often brought into the most intense and difficult combat situations. He trained as a member of the 5th Ranger Battalion at Camp Forest in Tennessee, then was assigned to Fort Pierce in Florida, where he got his first taste of what was in store when he was put out into the Atlantic by ship and then returned to shore in rubber amphibious boats with 40-pound packs. Bill was adept in the water, but some of his fellow soldiers didn't even have any idea how to swim, nor were they asked if they could swim. He was sent overseas to a base in Scotland for further amphibious and combat training. He was assigned to the headquarters division of the 5th Ranger Battalion, in charge of 8 soldiers whose job it was to keep lines of radio communication open between headquarters and units in the field. He knew he was going to war. Bill and his fellow soldiers received word of the objective 3 days prior to be in the first wave that would attack the beaches of Normandy in what became known as D-Day. He and other soldiers were taken by ship across the English Channel. They started loading the amphibious boats at 6 a.m. on June 6, 1944. They were 10 miles out, and everybody was laughing at first, giddy for combat after 2 years of difficult training. The water was very rough. They had each been equipped with brown paper bags in case of seasickness. My father was the toughest man I ever met. Nothing got to him. After the Olympics, I bought a Pitts aerobatic biplane because of my love of flying and my penchant for pushing the limits. It was a two-seater with a passenger seat in the front. I was tested many times by friends who thought they were tough. Give me your best shot. And they, of course, were the very first to get sick and plead for ejection. The only person who begged for more was my father. I tried everything. Loops, double loops, spins, going as high as I could, as fast as I could, and then stalling and plummeting down before regaining control. I gave him all I got, and he still wanted more. Except during D-Day. He did not get sick on the amphibious boat, but other soldiers did, violently so, those brown paper bags of little use. As they got closer to shore, they could see shells exploding on the beach. Bullets whizzed by them. Everybody was quiet then. The giddiness of going into combat gave way to the reality of death and fire and blood and fear. Bill hit Omaha Beach into a swirl of chaos, the briefing they received useless. Running communications lines was hopeless, and placed him in the thick of combat with a submachine gun he became proficient with during training. The soldier in front of him was brushed by an 88-millimeter artillery shell, enough to split his body open. Bill hesitated for a second. He wanted to do something. But regardless of what all the umpteen films and books say, the ultimate objective of every soldier who landed was self-preservation. So he kept on running to the seawall and crouched down with his entire body shaking. He looked behind him. An amphibious boat carrying flamethrowers was hit, and the boat exploded in a ball of fire. He saw men jumping overboard in flames and had to turn away. He wrapped the spurting hand of a fellow soldier who had lost several fingers. He watched as the officer in charge of communications went berserk from shell shock and tried to run away and had to be held down. He stayed in one spot for 10 minutes, then, convinced the spot had worn out as a sanctuary from death, moved to another one. He painstakingly worked his way up the beach, which was littered with the bodies of American boys. Later, as he and members of his unit made it off the beach into a small French village, he would have to participate in the killing of 2 young French women who were married to German officers and acting as snipers. My dad spoke little to the family about the experience of D-Day as we were growing up, except for the acknowledgement that what saves a soldier in horrible combat is luck. It wasn't my day to die. But every now and then a story came out. I remember him describing the final minute before the amphibious boat landed. The English coxswain manning the boat stopped and wanted the men to jump into neck-deep water. Some fellow soldiers had already drowned because of the combination of current and waves and carrying 100 pounds of gear. He refused to guide the boat any closer until an American officer on board put a gun to his head and said he would blow his brains out if he didn't get closer to shore. My father said that did the trick. The other story wasn't a story. It was a small and rectangular black-and-white photograph he took after his Ranger company had been sent to assist in the liberation and dismantling of the Buchenwald concentration camp in April 1945. It was the image of a railroad car flatbed piled 5 deep with the emaciated and naked bodies of victims like stacks of cordwood. My father showed me the picture as a young boy. I did not understand why. It was completely uncharacteristic of him and far too extreme for any child of 9 or 10 to process. But it ultimately helped me to understand him, how his periods of silence were caused by things he had seen as a young man that he would always see for the rest of his life. It made him emotionally detached, a trait I would have in my own life. Some people mention the word bravery in my transition from Bruce to Caitlin in the spring of 2015 at the age of 65. It is flattering. I certainly don't mind hearing it, and I appreciate the sentiment. But when compared to what my father and so many others went through, there is no bravery in becoming your authentic self. For me, it was a form of cowardice to wait so long. My father was a kind soul, even after all he had experienced during the war. He harbored no bitterness about anything or anyone. I am the same way in never harboring a grudge. I often wonder what he would have thought were he alive today. He loved my success in sports as I was growing up. His pride was indescribable when I won the Olympics. He reveled in my becoming an American hero. I often imagine the conversation we might have had, the reaction, the words he might say or not say, the look on his face. The one thing I never wanted to do was disappoint my dad. I always wanted him to be proud of me. He would not have understood my transition in a million years. He would not have been able to process it. Nobody of his generation would have understood it, just as many millions today cannot grasp that transitioning from a man to a woman or a woman to a man has nothing to do with your sexual preference and everything to do with the gender that is embedded within you from birth, regardless of your physical characteristics. I know there would have been initial shock, but I believe that once he got over it and started to see the good I could do in a very marginalized community, he would have been as proud of Caitlin as he was of Bruce. I know he would have wanted me to be happy, and maybe it would have made him happy to know that the turmoil in my life was finally over. But it would have taken him a long time to get to any kind of acceptance. My mom, who knew him better than anyone, wonders if he ever would have come around on the idea at all, no matter how he acted outwardly. You have that image of your son, and that's the image you have, and then it's Caitlin? Who is that? What is that? I still would have wanted to tell him. I never got the chance. My dad went back to the tree business after the war, ultimately starting his own company and servicing some of the great estates of Westchester County and Connecticut. He was frantic to be a good family man, and he was. We did everything together as a family growing up. My parents dedicated every weekend to their children, my older sister Pam, then me, then Bert, and ultimately Lisa. Our lives were pleasantly predictable, a 2-week vacation every summer camping in the Adirondacks, a trip to the farm in Ohio where my mother grew up. I went to New York City exactly once before I left for college, even though it was less than an hour away by train, and that was only because of a school trip. I didn't meet a single African American until I was in junior high school. The outside world was largely viewed through Look and Life magazines. The idea that several years later I would travel the world over as an acclaimed athlete was non-existent. The idea that there is a woman inside me was beyond non-existent. As I grew up, I exhibited no outward signs of femininity. I know that was puzzling to my mother and sister Pam after I told them I was transitioning. How could they live under the same roof with me during my childhood and adolescence and not see a single thing to suggest anything about me that was different, besides perhaps an aloofness and discomfort with affection? Because there wasn't anything. I never felt feminine, but I did identify as female. What is femininity anyway? It is entirely what anybody wants it to be. Because I continue to love car racing and motocross and motorcycling, does that somehow make me less feminine? It is only our tired and backward definitions of male and female characteristics that may make it seem so. When I was growing up, I hated having my hair cut. I hated going clothes shopping. Looking back, I wonder if these issues were an early sign of my gender dysphoria. Or maybe I just hated having my hair cut and going shopping. There are some things in life you just hate because you hate them. What I do know is the overwhelming insecurity I felt as a child was because of the difficulty I had reading aloud in school and the constant fear of being ridiculed. I always felt self-conscious, as if I didn't quite fit in, a social awkwardness that, while 1,000 times better today, is still within me. I crave friends, which sometimes makes me do desperate things. My father's pride and joy was his Army Ranger uniform. It hung in the closet, a row of medals across the breast of the jacket, including the Bronze Star. One day Pam, a year and a half older and about 7 at the time, clamored for him to wear it. He went to the closet and took the uniform out, only to discover that the medals were missing. I hung tough under interrogation. It took me a long time to crack before I confessed that I had taken the medals and given them to someone whose friendship I yearned for in return for some ducks I could raise in the backyard. Tragically, the medals could never be located. The ducks didn't last long either. Adding to my insecurities were the inevitable comparisons that were made to Pam. I idolized her. She was poised while I was not. She easily made friends while I did not. She easily blended into a crowd while I did not. She studied 5 hours a day to make straight A's, while I studied 5 minutes a day to scrape by with C's just so I could remain academically eligible for sports. There was something distant about me. I was there, but somehow not there, afraid of real emotion. I skimmed the surface because that was the only level I was willing to reveal because of what lay underneath, a sensation and desire pleasing and perplexing and puzzling. I was terribly at odds with myself, consumed by failure because of dyslexia and massive reading difficulties, and my poor self-image was only reinforced when I flunked 2nd grade and had to repeat it. My mom went to school conferences frequently to figure out what was wrong, but no one was interested in trying to diagnose the problem, much less render a diagnosis of dyslexia, which in my educational setting was unheard of back then. A lot of things in my life were unheard of back then. It wasn't until junior high that a school counselor mentioned the word, then after 10 minutes sent me back to class, which left me with 2 enormous areas of my life that were undiagnosed growing up, dyslexia and the issue of my gender. Teachers simply thought I was stupid or lazy. I did my best to be the teacher's pet, the goody-goody with or without an apple, so they liked me but still thought I was stupid and lazy. I dreaded going to school because of the fear that I would be called on to read and everyone would laugh at me. There was also something else. I was about 10. The curiosity would not go away. The object of it was in our 2nd-floor apartment in Sleepy Hollow Gardens, a sprawling complex of sturdy and simple red brick at the south end of Tarrytown by the foot of the Tappan Zee Bridge, built in the post-war boom. My mother's bedroom closet. I was too young to even remotely figure out why I was so fascinated by its contents. While I know now that my issues went to the core of my gender identity, I sometimes wondered if I was somehow trying to emulate Pam. Because I idolized her, maybe that also led to envy and wanting to be like her. I was clearly grasping for explanations. All I know for sure is that I was powerfully drawn into that closet, and the feeling didn't go away. I was smart about this. I waited until I knew my parents and sister would be out of the house for an extended period of time. I slid the white particle board doors open. I walked into my mother's closet. It was small because the apartment was small, just 2 bedrooms with a table in the kitchen where we ate most of our meals. My sister and I shared one of the bedrooms with a divider down the middle. My mother's closet. It seemed enormous, although it was not. I looked at the dresses and the skirts and the shoes. I brushed my hand over them so I could feel the cloth and cotton. I glanced around to make sure I was alone. I heard nothing. I picked out a dress. I used a piece of paper to mark its exact position so I could put it back in the same place. I went to a drawer to get a scarf. I watched the way it was folded so I could fold it exactly the same way when I was finished. There were no wigs around, and my hair was cut 50 style, a patch of lawn down to a quarter inch. So I took the scarf and wrapped it around my head and tied it under my chin to make it look like a wig. My mother's shoes were too big, so I used my sister's. I probably stretched them out a little, but I was not too worried. Not even Pam, as smart and savvy as she was, would ever suspect. I used a spot of my mother's lipstick. If she were to discover something amiss and I somehow got drawn into it, I had a plan for this as well. Pam stole it. It was the first of 1,000 times I would have a ready-made excuse in case I got caught. I looked in the mirror. Even then, I felt the sense of freedom that I would experience 30 or 40 years later in hotel rooms and lobbies. Something was right about this, but I couldn't tell anybody. So there was also more loneliness and isolation than I already felt. Even at the age of 10, my life had become a sealed box, and over time, the sides would become even higher and ultimately impossible to scale. Staying inside was not enough. I had to do more. I left the apartment, checking for signs of human life. It was dark because there was no way I would do this in daylight. I stayed within the confines of the complex, walking around the block once, up a hill and back down, then ran back to the apartment. The opportunities were rare, once every 6 weeks or so. I never saw anyone else when I went outside, except for this one time I walked down the hill and a car crept along behind me. I had my little dress on and my little scarf, and I could feel the headlights. But then it went by me. I just got away with it. I don't know why. The only point of reference I have is Christine Jorgensen, the former army soldier who went to Denmark to have surgery and came back a woman. Outed by the New York Daily News in 1952, she fascinated the entire world. It was the prurience that intrigued the public, as well as the medical advancement, a man becoming a woman, as if this were the next iteration of Frankenstein's monster, aberrant, abnormal, weird, wacky, secretly titillating to many who would never admit it. I glean what I can about Jorgensen, but I am too young to make any direct link to what I am feeling. I only know it feels so right. I only know it feels so wrong. I have no life outside school, and school too often is something of a disaster because of my dyslexia. My self-consciousness is like a second skin. Now add wearing a dress and scarf belonging to my mother. I haven't even made it to 11 yet. Cue the accordion. With the exception of schoolwork, which I pretty much suck at except for math and mechanical drawing later on in high school, the accordion is the first thing I ever really try to do. I have two friends who have formed a little band together. One plays the guitar and the other the accordion. I cannot think of anything cooler than being in a band. But being uncool, I have no idea what cool really is. I love all the buttons on the accordion, and the way you have to let it breathe in and out like a pumping heart. The guitar with those six lonely strings seems boring to me. So I go with the accordion, although in hindsight, I now realize it would have been cool only if you lived in Sicily. I tell my parents I want to play the accordion. I don't think this activity